I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. We talk now of Leonardo da Vinci and his most famous painting, the masterpiece that is The Last Supper. It's the subject of a new book, Leonardo and the Last Supper, by the best-selling and award-winning author Ross King. He joins me now to discuss the book. I'll ask him about da Vinci and how he came to paint The Last Supper, what it's meant since, like what is its legacy, and what's happened to it physically in terms of the myth surrounding it. Ross King has won the Governor General's Award for his previous book, The Judgment of Paris. Other books he's written include books about Michelangelo and Machiavelli. His last book was Defiant Spirits, the Modernist Revolution of the Group of Seven, which was nominated for the Charles Taylor Prize. RossKingBooks.com is his website. This book is published by Bond Street Books, an imprint of Doubleday. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Vancouver this day, Ross King. Dr. King, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
How did da Vinci come to paint The Last Supper? I guess he was, 40 at the time?
That's right. Actually, he was a little over 40, which might have been slightly worrying for him, given the fact that the average life expectancy in Italy in the 15th century was 40.
Uh-huh.
And so had he, one of the things I discussed in the book is the way in which he had reached the age of 40 without really creating a masterpiece. Everyone seems to have agreed that he was capable of producing a fantastic work of art, but he, by the age of 40, had still not done it, which is significant when you think that a younger contemporary of his, Michelangelo, had created the Pietà by the time he was 25, and the David by the time he was 29. Leonardo couldn't point to any work of his youth that was any kind of equivalent to that. So how he ended up getting The Last Supper was almost by default, or it was a kind of compromise or a consolation prize for him. He had spent the previous 8 to 10 years, the better part of a decade, on a project that he really wanted to execute, which was the enormous bronze equestrian monument honoring the father of the reigning Duke of Milan, the father being Francesco Sforza. Leonardo attacked this commission with great alacrity. He wanted to create a horse that was 23 feet in height. It was going to be larger than any and more spectacular than anything ever executed by the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, and certainly by anyone else in the 15th century. Sadly for him, he lost that commission because in 1494, around the time he had finished making his gigantic model for the horse, which poets duly began celebrating and beginning to make his plan to cast it, war broke out with the French, the war between Italy, specifically the Kingdom of Naples, and the French king, Charles VIII. And in times of war, bronze becomes very valuable. Mm-hmm. And his Leonardo found his 75 tons of bronze that he was ready to melt and pour into his casing to make his giant statue was confiscated to be turned into gunmetal, essentially to be turned into cannons. And so poor Leonardo had his dream commission whipped away from him really at the last minute, what had been a labor of love for about 10 years. And so as a consolation prize, he was given the task of something much less prestigious, which was painting a wall in a room where a band of friars ate their lunch. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, then is the Last Supper.
How long did it take him?
Well, to be perfectly honest, no one is absolutely certain. I think he began it, i.e. began making his sketches, drawings, and thinking about it almost immediately after the confiscation of his bronze. In other words, in the last few weeks or months of 1494, he seems to have finished it sometime, certainly by the beginning of 1498, and possibly as early as the late summer of 1497. So it took him 2.5-3 years of work, and which is about the right amount of time for a work of that size. It's 30 feet wide by 15 feet high, multi-figure composition with very complex poses. But I think the interesting thing about him doing it in the space of only a couple of years, and a couple of years in which he's, as I describe in my book, involved in all sorts of other projects mm-hmm. as well, is that Leonardo was someone who was famous for not finishing things. The Bronze Horse maybe was not his fold, but there were many other commissions that he walked away from after getting halfway into them. He left Florence in 1482 as a 30-year-old with various commissions for altarpieces smoldering behind him. He left dissatisfied patrons behind. He was involved in litigation in one case with people who were unhappy with his progress on and the payment he demanded for one of his works of art. So it's really quite remarkable that he did manage to complete the Last Supper under fairly adverse circumstances and in some ways very much against his will in the space of 2.5 or 3 years.
And how long was it before he died, after he finished?
It was a couple of decades. Yeah. He died in 1519, so he did go on. He lived another 20 years or so. So he died in his late 60s, which was really not bad going for someone born in 1452.
And at the time of his death, was this his most famous painting, or was that the Mona Lisa?
This was his most famous painting, and there's a very simple reason for that. Many more people were able to see the Last Supper because it was relatively easy to get into, especially if you were a dignitary of some sort or a painter, to get into the Church of Santa Maria delle Grazie in Milan, where he painted it, and to see it. The Mona Lisa was virtually unknown when he died, and in fact it wasn't very well known for decades afterwards because of the fact that Leonardo kept it in his studio. It was commissioned from him in 1503, but he didn't finish it anytime soon. He kept it with him. He seems to have, it could be argued that he thought it was his best painting because he kept it with him until his death. And it was known about in Florence after he died in France. He went away to the court of Francois I of France and he took the painting with him. But when he died in France, very few people in Italy had actually seen the Mona Lisa, likewise in France. And so the Last Supper and the image, both Leonardo's drawings for it and then copies made of it by other painters and engravers, spread the word of that painting. And so it really, by the end of his lifetime and then for many decades after his death, was far and away his most famous painting.
Now you're talking to someone, Dr. King, who doesn't have an appreciation for art, but yet found this book, from what I've read of it, quite fascinating. So you'll pardon the inane questions. In terms of the depiction of Christ and the apostles in the picture, in the painting, heretofore, was that how people thought that they sat around at that table?
It was not. Leonardo, and the question is not inane. It's actually a very good point about the way Leonardo transformed the genre of the Last Supper, so much so that we now, when we mention a Last Supper painting, His is the painting that we think of.
Exactly.
And he really created the new template for everything that followed. What he did that was so different from everyone before him was injected a drama and dynamism into it. It's interesting to think that he bought a Bible at the end of 1494. We have in his own hand that he kept a lot of records, and one of the things he recorded was a Bible that he bought in the last months of 1494. And I think he wanted to go back to the original source. He knew other Last Supper paintings. There were quite a few of them in Florence, but he wanted to do something different. And it's almost like he decided, I'm going to go back to the original source and read what actually happened at that table in Jerusalem. And I think what he read made him realize that it was a very dramatic scene. Heretofore, how you had painted a Last Supper was to dispose 13 men around a table, usually 12 on one side, mm-hmm. Christ and 11 of the apostles, and then Judas on the opposite side of the table to single him out. Mm-hmm. You would put John asleep on the bosom of Christ, as the Gospel of St. John says, and the rest of the apostles would be sitting in calm contemplation. And that was because of the fact that the Last Supper, painted in a refectory, in other words, where the monks and nuns ate their meals, were meant to be a kind of reflection of the monastery itself. And so as you as a friar or nun ate your meal and you imitated what you saw on the wall overhead. Leonardo seems to have decontextualized the painting, taken it out of the context of the refectory and back into and injected into it the drama that he read in the biblical representation of it, in which we have, if we think about it, an incredibly dramatic scene in which a charismatic leader and his band of brothers, specially hand-picked assistants upon whom he's endowed special powers to heal the sick, to cast out demons, etc., are gathered in the middle of an occupied city whose authorities are plotting against them, waiting for their moment to strike. And all the while, as they gather for this solemn feast, a traitor is among them, waiting for his moment to strike. And I think Leonardo was captivated by this story. He was, as I discussed in the book, he loved literature. He read a lot. He told stories as well. And I think he recognized that this really was something special. So what he wanted to put into the painting was something much more than other painters had done.
What was his relationship to Catholicism at the time?
It's difficult to say. In much later after his death, and I think particularly in the last century or two, he's been described as a heretic. But there's absolutely nothing, and that really comes from a statement made in 1550 by one of his early biographers, Giorgio Vasari, who said that Leonardo maintained heretical opinions. But in fact, there's absolutely nothing in any of his writings that smacks of heresy. More to the point, when he does something like Anatomy, which the Church didn't condemn in the 15th century, he is anatomizing helped him to appreciate what he called the greater glory of God. He thought man was the most amazing machine, and that it could only be understood through some higher being that had created it. So I don't think he was especially pious, and he certainly had took a dim view of certain aspects of Catholicism, in particular friars, although it could find friars and monks, although I could find no evidence that he fell out with the Dominicans at Santa Maria delle Grazie at the time that he was painting. But I think his relationship was probably very much the same as many other people's at that time, that he had a kind of questioning belief. He certainly read passages of the Bible, such as the story of the flood, with a somewhat critical eye and said, how on earth could 40 days and 40 nights of rain have caused seashells to have been swept to the top of mountains, because he, climbing the Dolomites, had found what we now know were fossils, in which he thought must have been shells brought up from the bottom of the ocean by Noah's flood. Mm-hmm. And so he maintained a critical stance toward it, but I think it would be very difficult to say he was an atheist or a non-believer, or even more, a heretic.
So in terms of how he painted it, he's in this room. He's got to paint the wall, essentially. He's on scaffolding. How does he see the paint? Does he sketch it out? He had models, I guess, as well, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
What he should have done, and in many ways it's a tragedy that he didn't do it, was to paint in fresco. That would have been the expectation, that when you painted a wall or a vault, you used the very technical, specialized technique known as fresco. The Italian word affresco, which describes it, has its root word fresco, which means fresh, and that refers to the fact that you painted on fresh, i.e. wet, plaster. And so you had to get your pigments, which were diluted only with water, you had to get them onto the wall, onto the wet plaster before it dried. And when it dried, it locked the pigments into the plaster, essentially making them part of the wall. Mm-hmm. And fresco was described as an extremely durable method of painting. And, for example, Michelangelo's fresco on the vault of the Sistine Chapel, which was done in the true fresco technique, 500 years later, it was unveiled 500 years ago next month, is still in extremely good condition because of that particular technique. Leonardo had no experience at fresco. He had never, by the age of 42, had never painted a fresco. And generally, you would start learning how to do it at the age of 13. And what's more, Fresco was ill-suited to his manner of working. He liked to tweak. He liked to go back and repaint. He liked to experiment and redo things on his wooden panel, for example, when he was painting an altarpiece. And you couldn't do fresco that way. You had to work extremely quickly because you were working against the clock. And so what he did, tragically in some ways for art history, was invented a new technique of painting, which was to, or as I discuss in the book, he didn't invent it. It was a generation or so earlier, a couple of people had experimented with it, and he then took the experimentation a step farther. What he did was painted with oil paint and tempera paint, a kind of combination of the two, on a dry wall. And what that meant, obviously, was that he that the pigments were not locked into the plaster the way they would have been in fresco. And so the inevitable result of that, and what all painters were warned about, there were all sorts of cautionary tales of people who had tried to do this and failed. And sadly, Leonardo, who was the greatest scientist painter of all time, was undone by his deficiency in his technique. And very quickly, in his own lifetime, the paint started flaking off of the wall.
There's an idea of that he sort of did that on purpose, that he didn't want it to last. Does your book speak to that?
I simply don't believe that. He had grown up surrounded in Florence. He came to Florence probably at the age of 12, 13, or 14. No one's absolutely sure when. A country boy from Vinci, little village outside of Florence, he comes to the city, and he sees things like the dome by Filippo Brunelleschi. He sees the statues of Donatello, the bronze doors of Lorenzo Ghiberti, all of these things which are extremely durable and are going to last as they have for many, many centuries. And he wanted to be part of that pantheon. I don't have any truck with that theory. He was not trying to... I think in our postmodern world, we have this idea of something that could be, you would create something that's very disposable. Leonardo talked about how he wanted to create a work of fame. I think it would have been quite unusual for an artist to create something that would evaporate before everyone's eyes in the space of only a decade or two. So I don't believe that. I think the reason it vanished was because of his deficient technique, which was nevertheless one of the things that made it such a great painting. Because he painted in oil paint, his colors could be brighter, he could rework his figures more, and he could create a much more stunning display than you could in fresco. Essentially, he was creating an altarpiece that was 30 feet across, but it was an altarpiece that had a flaw at its heart, and it began to degrade, but I think very much against his wishes.
The other thing that people are talking about in the reviews of this book, primarily in Britain, where the book's been out for a while now, is the idea that he painted himself into the portrait, that some of the faces of the apostles bear his. Did he?
Yeah, I believe he did. This is my theory, and so... I'm not sure how far I want to go with it, but my evidence for this is that in 1498, right around the time that he finished his work, a friend of his, a poet in Milan, wrote a poem lampooning a painter who he said put his image into all of his paintings. It seems that he is referring to Leonardo da Vinci in this poem. And so my question is, if he's referring to Leonardo, what painting is he referring to? And it seems most likely, given that The Last Supper has just been unveiled and created this sensation, that and the fact that it's a multi-figure composition, and Leonardo had to find 13 models, it seems most likely that he's talking about The Last Supper. And so I began to think, who is Leonardo in The Last Supper? The difficulty of identifying him is that there's not actually any kind of a good portrait of him from the 1490s. We don't know what he looked like at the time that he painted The Last Supper. The only good representation of him was done more than a decade later when he was about 60 years old. And so I started thinking about if Leonardo was going to make himself into one of the apostles, who would it be? Mm-hmm. It seemed most likely to me that it was St. Thomas, Doubting Thomas, the man who's behind Christ holding his index finger in the air. And the reason I think that it's Thomas is really twofold. In the first place, the author of the poem claims that it's not only the features of the painter that appear in this work, it's also his actions and ways, what he calls his gestures and expressions. And it seems that the pointing finger became a kind of Leonardo trademark, so much so that, as I discuss in the book, a number of years later, Raphael did a portrait of Leonardo as Plato in his fresco, The School of Athens. And so it seems that this, if you knew Leonardo da Vinci, this was the kind of signature gesture of his that he put in the painting and maybe used as his own emblem. Thomas is pointing into the air. Thomas is the one who doubts, who's the anatomist, the man who puts his finger into the wound of Christ. He's someone who, like Leonardo, will not take anything on the authority of others. He has to see for himself and to touch and to feel. And so it seemed to me that there's a possibility, a strong possibility, that Leonardo put himself into the Last Supper and that self-portrait, is the one of Thomas.
And the gestures that the apostles make in the painting, they're more Italian than anything else, aren't they?
That's right.
Absolutely.
It's one of the remarkable things about the painting is the use of facial expression and hand gesture. The German poet Goethe, when he went to Italy at the end of the 18th century, said that Leonardo had a distinct advantage over, for example, North European painters when he did a Last Supper, because of the fact that he could tap into the almost ritualized hand gestures, the way that the Italians used their hands, and almost verbally as they spoke. And I discuss in the book a treatise written in the 19th century that tries to explain Italian hand gestures of the 19th century and the way they can be linked up to Renaissance, or more especially ancient Roman hand gestures. And so the Italians certainly did and do use hand gestures, and Leonardo exploited these very effectively in his painting. But as I discuss, it's not easy to know exactly what all of them mean. Yeah. Even the book written in the 19th century by this man Di Giorgio on hand gesture talks about the ambiguity of them and the fact that some of them, for example, the horn hands, when you hold your index finger and your pinky in the air, that can have numerous different meanings depending on the context. And so one of the things I look at is the way that Leonardo uses these hand gestures, which to us look very natural, but to the Dominicans, for whom, after all, the painting was executed, mm-hmm. it had very specific meanings. So, for example, the hand gestures of Christ, which appear to be making a kind of revelation or pointing at the bread or gesturing at the wine, really are an indication of the sacrament, the fact that he is about to institute the Eucharist. We see St. Peter clutching his knife, and this is, of course, that's sort of a prophetic announcement, because Peter is going to use that knife a number of hours later to slice the ear off of Malchus, the servant of the high priest. His knife is pointing at Bartholomew, who's at the end of the table, and Bartholomew, of course, is martyred, as were many of the apostles, and Bartholomew had martyred him where he was flayed of his skin. And so Peter's knife really points to two different episodes coming up, one from the Passion of Christ and another from the martyrdom of St. Bartholomew. And so the painting is incredibly rich with symbolic meaning as well as a kind of naturalistic gesture. To us, it all looks, I think, very natural, if perhaps somewhat overheated. But I think to the Dominicans looking at it, they would have taken maybe a little more away from it than we would 5 centuries later.
Now, the restorations on the work started as soon as, say, 10, 20 years after he finished, right?
That's right.
Yeah, and the state of the Last Supper today, I mean, has it stayed true to how Da Vinci did it, or did you have people like, well, what's that woman in Spain, the elderly woman that...
Oh, yes,
Cecilia,
the
yes.
woman who did the...
Yeah.
Thankfully the restorers worked for some 20 years on, I think it was actually 22 years on the Last Supper, had greater facility and respect than this poor woman in Spain who, created a dreadful portrait of Christ with her restoration. It, as far as can be known, the huge problem, of course, was that the restoration took place after multiple restorations over many centuries. And as I describe in the book, many of those earlier restorations were incredibly violent. The wall was scraped, it was washed with caustic soda, incompetent painters were brought in the 18th century to try to tart it up, and some of them, one of them turned Bartholomew's leg into a chair leg, another turned one of Thomas's hand into a loaf of bread. When they started work in the mid-1970s, the work was really in a very bad state, not only insofar as it was coming off the wall and mildew, it had problems with mildew, etc., but it had been degraded, actively degraded by previous restorers. And so what they did is went back to Leonardo's drawings and then back to some of the earliest copies of the painting to try to understand the facial expressions of the apostles and the gestures, and also to some extent the coloring. And so, for example, as I describe in the book, one apprentice who was on the scaffold with Leonardo later became a painter in his own right, a man named Gian Pietrino, and he, in about 1515, did his own full-size canvas painting of the Last Supper, which is now is owned by the Royal Academy and is at Oxford University. That was actually sent to Milan, and the restorers there studied it in order to try to bring the painting back as far as possible to what it would originally have been in 1497, 1498.
This is just such fascinating stuff, Dr. King. I didn't think that it would whiz by, as this conversation would whiz by as it has. I'm really enjoying the talk, and I'm looking forward to finishing this book. Good luck with the book.
Many thanks. It was a great labor of love on my behalf, so I'm delighted to hear that you've been enjoying it.
Yeah, rosskingbooks.com. That's the website for more. The book is called Leonardo and the Last Supper. Bond Street Books is its publisher, its author, Ross King, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.